This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, as the political season heats up and pitchers and catchers head to Florida, we decided let's play two. Coming up tomorrow, me and Colin McEnroe will take on politics for the first in our monthly series of WNPR election doubleheaders on Where We Live and the Colin McEnroe Show. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk about how difficult it is for new people to break into the political system, what makes them even want to do it in the first place. Then at 1 o'clock, we'll tackle the strangeness of Connecticut politics. We've been home to mavericks and outsiders of all kinds. Is Connecticut just different? Well, find out more tomorrow in our election doubleheader with me and Colin McEnroe at 9 o'clock and 1 o'clock on WNPR. You know how we love Main Street preservation and architecture here on Where We Live. Sometimes, though, you need to step back and ask, is it really better to spend money fixing up an old building than replacing it with a new one? Well, that's part of the conversation at an event sponsored by the Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation coming up this Friday called Historic Places and Property Values in Connecticut's Economy. What do these all have in common? Donovan Ripkema is a principal of Place Economics in Washington, D.C., who's going to be here for this presentation on Friday. He joins us by phone. Donovan, thank you so much for being here on Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, maybe you can explain historic preservation tax credits and what benefit they have for a place like Connecticut.
Well, over the last decade, where the state of Connecticut, the legislature has been smart enough to have actually established three tax credits, what it really does is serve as a very powerful magnet for private capital to go into historic resources all around the state. And in doing that, it is among the most effective job creation tools there is in Connecticut.
When you say effective job creation tools, I looked at some of the statistics in this report, and they seemed a little bit mind-blowing, frankly. Maybe you can run through a little bit of how big a job creator this is from the research you've done.
Well, the basic measurement in economic development, whenever you read about job creation numbers, it comes back to basic models about saying, if there's $1 million worth of output, what does that mean in numbers of jobs created and amount of household income generated? And then you can compare across any kind of industry categories. If we have the output of $1 million of automobile manufacturing, or $1 million worth of legal services, or $1 million worth of hamburgers sold, what does that mean to Connecticut in terms of jobs created? And in the case of historic preservation in Connecticut, every time someone spends $1 million in the rehabilitation of a historic building, that means a total number of jobs of about 14 and a half jobs and a household income of about $831,000. Now, kind of in isolation, that doesn't mean much, but you spend $1 million on new construction, and that's only a little less than 12 jobs. Or you spend $1 million on manufacturing computers in Connecticut, that would only be 3 jobs. So the same amount of output and huge difference in the numbers of Connecticut citizens being employed.
And so, again, we're talking about historic rehabilitation, something fueled by historic tax credits in a state like Connecticut. Maybe you could explain a bit more about why you'd get so many more jobs, so much more economic benefit out of rehabilitating an old structure as opposed to creating a new one. It would seem as though there'd be so much more manufacturing, there'd be demolition, there'd be other things going into a newly constructed home or building that you wouldn't have in a historic one.
Great question, and the reason is this, is that as a general rule of thumb, in Connecticut, a new construction, if you spend X dollars on new construction, half of that is going to labor, half of that is going to materials. But when you spend that same amount of money on historic rehabilitation, between 60% and 70% of that goes to labor, with the balance being in materials. So that has this whole ripple effect. Number one, for the same amount of money, when more is going to labor than materials, it means more jobs are created. Second, much of the materials that we incorporate into a building, whether new or old, are brought in from some other place, but we're buying the services of the carpenter and the labor and the electrician from across the street. And third, once you buy and install a sink, the sink doesn't spend any more money. But that plumber gets a haircut and buys groceries on the way home and joins the Y, each time recirculating that paycheck within the community. So that's what ends up with this decidedly greater local economic impact.
If you're involved in historical preservation in Connecticut, you can join us 860-275-7266. We'd like to hear about your story. 860-275-7266. Email wherelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. We're talking with Donovan Ripkema, who's principal of Place Economics, a D.C.-based real estate and economic development consulting firm. He'll be here for a Connecticut Trust for Historic Preservation event at the Lyceum coming up this Friday, March 2nd. More information at cttrust.org. Maybe we can talk a little bit about historic buildings and energy efficiency. One of the things that would seem to be a huge cost driver here is, well, look, I've got an old home myself, and I know that it's very drafty and it's not necessarily the most efficient thing. Many might ask, if I build a brand new building up to code with all the latest materials, won't it be much, much more energy efficient than rehabbing my old structure?
Well, really, it's a great question and a very legitimate one, and two responses to that. First of all, the historic buildings need to be energy efficient, and people shouldn't have to be expected to live in drafty places just for the sake of preserving historic buildings for somebody else. The good news is that, in particularly in recent years, preservation architects, contractors, and engineers have really figured out how to address those issues of both energy efficiency and comfort in older buildings, both residential and commercial. The second issue, however, that's really an important one, and in all the measurement systems there are for energy efficiency, is this issue, is that the measurements are all in terms of current energy consumption, and virtually none of them consider how much energy was incorporated into the building when it was built. And the amount of energy it takes to build a building is 15 to 30 times the amount of energy that a building uses annually. So the function of measuring energy ought not just to be, you know, how much electricity did I buy this year, but also how much energy is incorporated into that building already. And that's a concept called embodied energy, and it's a huge contribution. There's energy that's been spent and now incorporated in a building, and when we tear that building down and throw it away, we have in fact thrown away that energy that's already been expended on our behalf, and we now have to re-spend that energy or more to dig out the ore from the ground and make it into steel and transport it to the site and incorporate it into a new building.
Well, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I'll just say, if the currency that we're talking about is energy, I totally understand what you're saying. But here in Connecticut, we have this long tradition of really only necessarily doing things if they are in our own economic interest.
Yeah.
And so it would be wonderful that we would spend less energy. But how can you make the case that we'll spend less money retrofitting an older home or an older structure to be energy efficient than building a newer structure that will inherently be more energy efficient from day one?
Well, maybe it'll be more energy efficient, although it wasn't part of those two studies we did over the last year in Connecticut. But there was just a study released in the last month from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, who did a peer-reviewed scientific study on energy use. And what they found is that for virtually every building typology, in fact, a properly retrofitted historic building is, in fact, as or more energy efficient than the most energy efficient of new buildings. Mm-hmm. And it takes up to 45 years to retrieve the energy that it takes to build an energy-efficient new building in its operational cost. And a whole hell of a lot of those buildings are not going to last 45 years.
So make a case for us about how this will lead to social vitality, economic well-being, beyond just the jobs created. When you preserve a historic structure, what exactly does that mean for the community?
Well, I think that the name of your program really says it. It really is the place we live. And it's the kind of quality and character of our place that generates our attachment to it. That here is not just another house, but it's a house that, you know, six generations of Connecticut citizens have lived in and added to. And it really is this sense of connection that's almost not my area is economics, but it's almost not measurable economically, but it's this decidedly important contribution to this kind of ephemeral thing called community. And whenever that sense of place, sense of community, sense of differentiation is measured, though, that core of buildings that are the physical manifestation of history, that's a critical part of that.
Now,
Connecticut citizens in little towns just thrilled with the quality of that their ancestors left them.
Now, many people are under the impression that, if your home is located in a, local historical district, that somehow that's going to drive down the value of your home because there's going to be all sorts of regulations on it. What have you found out about that, about historic districts in, cities and towns?
Well, what we learned in Connecticut last year in the study on that exact issue, very consistent with the studies that have been done around the country for the last 15 years, is far from being a drag on historic districts. In fact, that being located in that local historic district where there is some oversight and some control about what someone can or cannot do with their building, in fact, that has a not a value detriment. It has a value enhancement to the properties that are so affected. And here's the reason why. It's not that somebody's paying a premium to have to go and appear before some goofy preservation commission. It is I now have the confidence that the lunatic across the street can't be doing something to his house that has an adverse effect on mine. And so every place we looked, that there was a positive increase in value of properties in local historic districts. But the last, as you know, everyone in Connecticut knows, the last 4 years we've been in a real estate chaos. So we looked at a different issue. We looked at the patterns of foreclosure in four communities in Connecticut, and compared the rates of foreclosure in local historic districts with that extra layer of regulation versus the rest of the community. Mm-hmm. And among those, compositely among those four communities, the rate of foreclosure was half. Well, that's not a statistical fluke. That's pretty important evidence about this stabilizing effect that those districts have on property values.
Is it just because people care more about the properties they own?
Well, I don't want to accuse somebody in a brand new subdivision of not caring about where they own. I think that there is this sense of stability and a less volatility in those property values in those historic districts, and this kind of confidence that I can make an investment today and it's going to be protected tomorrow, that in fact, it's not that, people didn't in historic districts didn't in financial trouble, that happened every place, but when you are in trouble because there's this less downside movement, that there's somebody to buy the property before it goes into foreclosure.
And just to be clear, we're talking about two different things here, local historic districts that may be in your community, and also state or national registered districts. These are also some places in Connecticut, but they're different things than a local historical district. Maybe you can explain.
Sure. A National Register Historic District is a very important thing. It's a wonderful tool, and it's a notation that your neighborhood is important in the kind of history of the nation. But it provides no protections whatsoever to the individual properties. You could own a National Historic Landmark property in Connecticut, and if it were not protected by some local ordinance, you could build it up, tear it down, paint it red, white, and blue tomorrow with impunity. It's an honorary, and it's a threshold for commercial properties, a threshold to federal tax credits, but no protections. The protections emerge when the local citizens say, we want to set up an historic district and protect this historic neighborhood.
As far as tax credits for historic preservation, how does Connecticut rate comparatively to the other states?
Well, Connecticut has three different tax credits and is candidly a little later into the game than many other states. But the effect has been dramatic. As we looked at the tax credits came into being in Connecticut in the first decade of the 21st century. And while there was some increase in the state GDP, we looked at the time period 2000 to 2005 and then 2006 to 2010. And while the state GDP went up, nominally, and construction activity went up nominally, the amount of historic preservation in that second period went up five times as much. Well, that clearly is this catalytic effect that those tax credits, which in Connecticut are available for both residential and commercial properties, had a huge impact on people's willingness to make that investment.
I want to go to David in South Windsor. David, you just have about 30 seconds or so. I apologize. Go ahead.
All right. That's all right. I got a house built in 1773, so it's older than the country. And as far as you're talking about, I've done all kinds of things to insulate my house, following all the rules. And it's not going to be as energy efficient. It's just not. And I don't care what studies you've done. It's just not possible to make it the same kind of efficiency. And as far as your tax credits, I mean, really, that's almost like reverse taxation. Because most of the people, myself included, are upscale, higher-end people. We've got plenty of money. to buy this house and restore it.
Well, David, I apologize because I just want to get a quick thing. You, Donovan, in just 30 seconds, you hear what David's saying there. How do you answer him?
Well, first of all, what's interesting in Connecticut is the vast majority of the tax credits did not go to, you know, high-income people in high-income neighborhoods. About 90% of the tax credit investment in historic properties in Connecticut, in fact, went into neighborhoods with very modest household incomes.
Well, and I'll tell you what, we're going to have to leave it there. Donovan Ripkema from Place Economics, thank you so much. Coming up next, we'll talk with Alex Lambert about her life in crime. This is Where We Live.